Welcome to episode 22 of The Mark of a Druid. I do suggest you start the story at the beginning. And if you have any questions or want more information about me, the author, Rhonda R. Carpenter, then please go to themarkofadruid.com. Now on to our story. Chapter 31, When Push Comes to Shove. Andrea stepped from her car, collected her luggage from its trunk, and entered her home. Oh, with a sigh, she placed the luggage by the door to be dealt with later. She retrieved the mail from the box at the street and thumbed through the envelopes with disgust. Bill, what's this? The tape, which was obviously not delivered by a postal worker, had a note attached to it. To her disappointment, she realized that her appointment to meet David Landrum had slipped her mind. He deserved an apology, she decided. She dialed the number on the note. His voicemail picked up, and after the beep, she left a short but regretful message. The front door opened as she set the receiver down.
Richard!
Hi, honey. How was your time with your dad?
It was great, Mom. Anything to eat?
Andrea was sure he had not been deprived of food while with his dad, but 12-year-old boys do have unstoppable appetites. How about we order pizza, and you can tell me about your trip?
Sounds like a plan. Pepperoni?
He smiled. You got it, she said. After she called in the order, they chatted for a while. When Richard went to his room to put his backpack away, Andrea took her luggage to her bedroom and unpacked.
What's this tape, Ma?
Richard's voice boomed across the house.
"Something an acquaintance wants me to listen to," she replied. "Go on, play it."
Richard wasted no time putting the tape into the stereo system. The sound of a soft flute filled the room, and Richard rolled his eyes.
"Sounds like classical. You sure you want to hear this?"
"Why not? It couldn't hurt us to have a bit of culture," she grinned, entering the room. They sat on the couch, listening for a few minutes, and then both of them closed their eyes. The music washed over them, and images flooded all around them. Neither of them heard the door when the delivery man arrived. It was 8:20 when Lisa, sitting behind the wheel of her Volvo, swerved to miss a lane jumper. Her sharp intake of breath followed by a tiny whine of a scream caught in her throat.
"Thank God," she mumbled. "That asshole almost hit me."
Instinctively, her hand went to her tummy and patted the baby. It was not yet obvious to others that she was pregnant. Her other hand gripped the steering wheel tighter than need be, but she wanted to make sure she had control of herself and the vehicle. Her cell phone rang. She didn't answer it, afraid to be distracted from the road for even an instant. A white, older model Cadillac sped up behind her, and she changed lanes to give the car a wide berth. She watched in the rearview mirror as it overtook her. Glancing out her window, Lisa was gripped by fear that threatened to choke off her air. The muzzle of a gun was aimed right at her. A bald Hispanic man leered menacingly. She began to slow down. A loud pop that could have been an exploding tire caught her ear just as the shot from the gun hit her in the neck. Everything happened so fast there was no time to react. Her car swerved, hitting the guardrail. Metal crushed metal, and the railing gave way. James Forrest knocked at his fiancée's door. Lori knew it was him before she peered through the spy hole. She had sensed him coming up the stairs. Sometimes the sight was completely frustrating.
"What do you want?"
Her voice was cold.
"Can we talk, Lori?" "What is there to talk about? You obviously aren't ready for the commitment you made, and..."
"Oh, hell," she thought, and opened the door. James stood slump-shouldered and red-faced before her. She waved him in and closed the door. He threw himself onto the couch and looked at her with the eyes of a sad puppy. Lori spun the platinum engagement ring around on her finger absent-mindedly. The silence in the room was deafening. Lori sat beside him. His hand went to her knee, and she pushed it away.
"Don't you even touch me after what happened today.
I'm not sure I want you to ever touch me again." James seemed confused.
"What did I do?"
"Oh, please.
Miss Phillips made it clear when she left the clinic that you made a pass at her. Don't try to deny it.
I did no such thing. I would never.
At least I don't remember anything from this afternoon. And the last thing I
was having lunch with David.
Lori didn't buy it, but she let him sit there without an argument. Tears welled in James's eyes. He shook as if standing on an iceberg. Then his head dropped to his hands and he mumbled,
"Lori, who is Ms. Phillips?"
Shock ran through her.
Is he for real?
David sauntered up to Samantha's door, rapping on the metal surface 5 times. "Enter!" David bowed at the waist with a sweeping flourish of his arm.
"My queen."
"About time. I thought you'd never get here. I hate to be kept waiting. Take off your clothes."
"Now," she demanded.
He obeyed without another word. Samantha pushed him to the floor. Gentleness was not on the menu tonight. She dragged her claws down his chest, and David moaned with delight. It took little effort on her part to rouse him. She straddled him as if mounting an inanimate object. He moaned. She slapped his face, stifling his sounds of pleasure. She threw her head back and laughed, pounding against him. Quivering Samantha climaxed. David's breathing became erratic, and she knew he wouldn't last much longer. A sadistic smile curled her lips as she rose, leaving him lying on the floor, unsatisfied.
"That was pathetic.
Finish yourself off, then shower, and come to me in the loft." She spun on her heel and left him prone on the floor.
"Yes, my queen," was all he said.
Richard stood dreamily. He walked to the kitchen and turned on the gas stove. The click, click, click of the electronic filament was a faraway sound in his mind. He held his arm over the burner. As his flesh began to burn, he screamed.
"Ow!"
Andrea, jarred awake, leapt to her feet and ran to her son. "Richard, God, what have you done?" He didn't answer. She yanked open the freezer, grabbed a handful of ice, and thrust it onto his forearm. She took a dish towel from the drawer to hold it in place. Richard cried, while Andrea rushed him to the emergency room. The ambulance arrived at the scene of an accident. A police officer put his cruiser in reverse while his partner motioned for a few more feet of pull. The teetering car rolled back onto the freeway overpass. Emergency medical personnel ran to the occupant's aid. The car was crushed on the passenger side and the driver slumped over in the seat. Blood gushed from a gunshot wound. The wide-eyed EMT tried to stop the bleeding. They loaded Lisa's unconscious form into the ambulance. One medical worker spoke on the radio to the hospital.
"Female, mid-20s, gunshot wound to the neck. She's lost a lot of blood. No exit wound.
How far out?"
crackled the doctor's voice. "2 minutes."
From the back of the rushing vehicle, the other medical technician fumbled with absorbent pads that were saturating faster than he could tear open a replacement. He put pressure on the wound, but he held little hope for this young woman. Sirens howled, tires squealed, and Lisa's eyes opened.
"My baby."
"She's pregnant," said the technician working on her.
"You've been shot. Hold on, hold on," he urged. The heart monitor flatlined.
Chapter 32, The Fog of Loneliness. Eve turned over in her sleep, but did not wake. A moan escaped her parched lips. Cosmo watched her and yowled as the clock radio began to play the tape within. The fur at the nape of his neck stood erect. Great billowing clouds of fine mist hung heavy in the air. A thin layer of moisture clung desperately to the trees. Overhead, hesitant droplets formed at the tip of each leaf before dropping to the sodden ground. Alian was aware of each impact and how it sent the decaying smell of the forest into the air and bits of muck onto her clothing. Dark, rich, fertile soil turned to mud beneath her leather-shod feet. The heavy scent of earth
mixed with the musty stench of rotting compost, encircled her as if it were a blanket. She inhaled the moist air. It filled her lungs the same way thoughts of loneliness filled her very soul. She looked over her shoulder back the way she'd come. The fog turned the distant torchlight into murky halos of dancing gold and orange light. The light could not reach into the darkness she felt in her heart, pulling her brat closer to her body. She turned, pretending just for a moment she was home, hugging Athene, and listening to Dubjila explain the procedure for extracting oils from seed. In that brief instant, Alian was safe, warm, and sheltered from all things unsure. The feeling fled as the sound of a nearby squirrel scratching in its nest caused anger to rise, hovering just below the surface of her awareness, then exploding. "You're in your nest protected, and you belong," she screamed to the squirrel. Alian raised her fists to the hazy moon. She called out for the woman she had known as her mother. "Arok, will I ever see Athene again? Tell me the truth. Were you my mother?" Tears streamed down her face. "Is she my sister? Who am I? Why am I here?" Her frustration turned to despair. She walked deeper into the forest as the night enveloped her. Alian replayed in her mind what Kanut had told her, what she had thought were lies. But were they lies? She had no answers. Thwarted and confused, Alian walked until she could take not one more step. She curled herself into a small ball in the crooked roots of a towering oak tree. The chattering of her teeth and the vibration of her muscles put her into trance. Visions of clouds and thick, heavy smoke filled her mind. She saw the red-haired woman with a sad expression on her face. The woman stood unmoving, but held the gaze of Alian. From behind the red-haired beauty entered Arok. She approached Alian. Arok came closer and reached out, gesturing her nearer. She longed to speak, but there were no words. Lifting her fingers to her lips, Arok signaled for silence and softly whispered, "Alian of the red hair, I have come to tell ye the truth, to show you what has, for the whole of your life, been hidden from you. 'Twas done for your own safety, child." Alian drew nearer to Arok, but still she did not reach to touch her. A bright white light streamed through the trees. Alian watched as the vision of a man in the distance became clear. He was tall and strong, with hair the color of fire. He rode on a great chestnut stallion. With him was a single man, a man who looked very much like Alian's captor, with his dark, chiseled features. She knew it could not be him, for the man's eyes were dark, not amber, and his beard was sandy. Arok pointed to the scene and whispered again, "Alian, watch and learn the truth." The two men rode to a small encampment. The red-haired woman from Alian's dreams met the fiery-haired man. As she watched, she saw a much younger Arok step to the red-haired woman's side and greet her as only a sister would. She gently kissed the red-haired woman on the cheek and then turned. Alian could see the woman was heavy with child. Alian watched in the stillness of a half-sleep and gathered most of this had taken place long ago. Arok looked to be very young, and the red-haired woman took her place beside the fiery-haired horseman. They greeted each other with a familiarity that Alian had yet to experience in her own life. They ate and talked of many things. Just as Alian was about to ask what this all meant, a flash of light struck the scene, and Arok was standing over the red-haired woman. She was in the heaviest throes of childbirth. Hovering around the woman was Dubjila, who had no wrinkles and no crown of gray. Seeing her teacher so young and vital was unnerving for Alian, and she wanted to reach out to her, but did not. Brosna shadowed Dubjila closely as she walked around the dwelling, preparing for the coming of the child in the ways of the druid people. A shiver of recollection ran so deeply through Alian's body that she almost lost the vision. But she managed, after several deep breaths, to calm herself and sink even deeper into the scene as it unfolded. Brosna and Dubjila worked as only twins can, Each anticipating the next move of the other with such synchronicity, Aliane felt as if she was watching an intricate dance in which the moves were practiced until each participant knew the steps by heart. Arok held the hands of the expectant mother and softly cooed her name. Gretich, breathe and push, the child is almost here. Dubjila moved to stand between her legs and placed her hands on Gretich's stomach, gently massaging the mound of unborn child which lay beneath. As Aliane viewed the coming of the child, a tuft of matted red hair became clear, and slowly, push by push, the head exited its nest. One shoulder, then another, and then the rest of the infant slipped from its mother. Aliane could see it was a girl child. Dubjila handed the baby to Brosna, without a word, who cleaned the newborn while the tiny one screamed with its first drawn breaths. Brosna cleared the baby's throat, and Dubjila looked the child over with surprise. She has the mark of the prophecy. Brosna, look. She carries the sign of Owen. Together they held the child to the sky and called to Bridge. In unison, they began the naming ceremony.
Give this new life a name worthy of her destiny.
As they swayed and chanted, Arok tended Gretich, mopping her face with a damp cloth and helping her to expel the afterbirth. When the chanting stopped, the twins looked to Arok and Gretich.
The child is Aliane of the Red Hair, the daughter of the Red Hair, the daughter of Brian Baru, and she is the holder of the mark. This child will save our way of life from its final destruction. When all others have given in to the new ways, she will carry our people to a new land, and the wolf shall lead her there.
Again the twins spoke in unison. Tears graced Aliane's face as she watched her own birth and naming. Then, with a flash of light, the scene changed. Gretich of the Red Hair, who Aliane now knew to be her birth mother, walked in the forest carrying her babe. She hummed under her breath. With her was Brian Baru. He took the child from her hands and asked her to tell him the prophecy again. He gently pulled the linen of the gown away from the babe's skin and looked at the mark which tied this child to a destiny that was being imparted to him by the only woman he had ever trusted more than his own mother, Bibin. Brian, my love, the prophecy is clear. This child holds the mark. The only king in Aaron's history who had brought peace to this land fathered her. Remember, a king of two minds, one grounded in the old ways, and one open to the new. The mark was promised to the wisest of all seers long before Christendom was known here in Erin. She is the one who will take the best of the living druids to a new land, preserving our way of life. The voyage will be one fraught with hardship, but as long as the man from the prophecy is there to help her, she will have a chance. And this man, he said, tell me of him. A druid he'll be, fully trained. He will come from across the sea. His name is unknown to us, but a changeling he will be. And even in his altered state, he will bear the mark, same as she. Gretich pulled the babe's gown over the mark, and Brian held his daughter close. Will he be born of the mark? Brian asked, his brows knitted over stunning sea-green eyes. The prophecy is clear. The gods will choose at his man-making, and the marks will be given then. The symbol of Arwen, topped with the sun, will be plain to see on the back of his right hand. Even though the mark will not be present from his birth, for him there will be no doubt in his abilities. He will be of the sea and of the land, of the wild animals and of the trees. He will be cunning and caring of his people and yours, raised a druid. He will also be a warrior and a sailor. This prophecy can only come to pass if the child you hold and a changeling join together as one before the fall of Erin's greatest king. There will come a time in Erin it is no longer a peaceful place, and the church has grown strong enough in power and influence. Its leaders wish the old ways to die. But, Gretich, my love, he said it so soft, she was barely able to hear him. I am the greatest king of our land, and I will do all in my power to see your people are never driven from our shores. Yes, Brian, I know. You will do everything you can. But these things will happen at the end of your days. Silence fell between them, and a great flash of bright light blinded Alian once more. The scene changed to a late autumn moonless night. Alian could see a tall and graceful woman hovering at the edge of Greditch's village. It was chilly enough in the forest that her breath could be seen on the air. The hood of her brat concealed her face. Alian watched as she moved to Greditch's dwelling. In her hand, she carried a small clay vial stoppered with a waxed coating. She entered the round house, and in the warm glow of the fire made sure she was undetected. She inspected each of the sleeping mats, searching for some sign of who slept in them. When she came to Greditch's, she touched the coarse covers, picking them up and lifting them to her nose. The smell which invaded her nostrils was that of mother's milk. Alian looked on the graceful, stoic woman as she opened the vial, and Alian wondered at her purpose. She covered the pillow with the crystallized powder. She made sure her hands never touched the substance, instead rubbing it with the blankets she still held. Even in her hoarse whisper, Alian could hear the rage in her voice. "To you, Greditch, and to your child, death cannot come quickly enough. The child he's so proud of cannot fulfill a destiny if it's dead. So be it, in the name of Gormlaith, Queen of Erin." She then left, as she had come, breaking not even a twig on the ground. Alian watched her move to the mount that was as black as the night, and right away. The scene moved back to the dwelling of her mother. Arok and the twins, Dubjila and Brosna, entered the room and went about their work. The baby fussed and squirmed each time Greditch drew close to the bed. The babe would scream and shiver. Arok took the child from Greditch's arm and sat by the fire rocking her. Greditch laid down on the bed and rested her head on the straw-stuffed pillow. Before three breaths had been taken, the room began to spin, and Greditch rolled from the bed to the floor, gasping for air. In an instant, the others hovered around her and tried to help. Brosna was the first to notice the crystalline powder still clinging to her face. "Touch nothing," she warned as she went to the bed, careful not to brush against the bedding. Arok cried and knelt, holding the child as she listened to the strained voice of her sister. "Raise her as your own and take her from Erin. She must learn of our ways and complete the prophecy. Everyone must think she's dead. My sister, you must keep her safe." Her last words were for her lover, Brian of the Baru. "Tell him I love him. And I will wait for him to come to me. I will wait." Her eyes rolled back into her head and she released her last breath. Cosmo hissed and swatted at the electronic device with his furry paw. After nudging it to the edge of the table, it teetered and fell to the floor. The cassette door popped open. The tape flew from the inside and skidded to a stop far beneath Eve's bed. I'd like to say thank you to all my listeners. Please come back and see me again next week if you have questions about the Mark of a Druid, or you'd like to know more about me, the author. Please go to my websites at themarkofadruid.com or rondacarpenter.com. Until next time, take care.